Morning, everyone. Can you hear me? Am I on? There I am. It's been a while since I've been up here, so it's good to be back in some ways. I'm not preaching Revelation. That's a good thing, isn't it? Yes, it is. Just over a month ago, Rob and I were working through the sort of the preaching schedule and what we would do in these remaining weeks, trying to divvy up how we'd finish off Revelation, what we'd do after that, how we'd handle April. And we saw that we were going to have about 2 weeks between the end of Revelation and the beginning, and then Easter. And we saw that I was going to end up with those 2 weeks. And so I had to come up with something that I thought was somewhat related to Easter and hopefully two messages that were related to each other. And So about a month ago, I said, I'll take each of the brothers in the story of the prodigal son. I thought that made sense, sort of. This is, in some ways, we approach Easter from one of these two perspectives of the brothers. And so started my initial research and working through that a little bit, and then our daughter left. And I put it that way because although the adoption process wasn't finished, we had considered her our daughter from the first day she came. And when that happened, I thought, well, I can't preach that prodigal son message now. I'm too raw. And so I just sort of let it sit there for a little bit. But earlier this past week, I was sort of reflecting on just another gentleman, a biblical scholar by the name of John Goldengay, and I've mentioned him before. I use a lot of his stuff here, and you might remember when we were doing our Psalm series, I talked about how John Goldengay's wife had multiple sclerosis for 40 years, and he was her primary caregiver, and he said that he was in many ways grateful for the way that their life together, as he watched her struggle with multiple sclerosis, the way that it had driven him into the Psalms as a result of that. And so I've really respected the way that he's sort of handled difficult times. And I was listening to a lecture by him one time, and he was teaching a class through the Old Testament, and it was an evening class. And his wife had died that morning after 40 years of struggling with MS. And he didn't just teach the class as though nothing had happened. And he didn't use the class as his personal counseling session either. And I thought, here's a man who can model good grief. And so I thought maybe there was a way to, you know, I thought I had a good idea, you know, this prodigal son and older brother two weeks before Easter. And so I thought maybe there's a way that I can sort of hold these two worlds together a little bit. And so I'm going to try that. This isn't my own personal counseling session, but I'm also not going to pretend like nothing's happened in my life because I'm walking with a limp these days. And one of the big messages of the story of the prodigal son is the heart of the father. And I thought, well, here's an opportunity for me to show that God's people a little bit of what the heart of the father looks like in this story. So I'm going to offer that to you. I don't know whether or not I'll be emotional, to be honest. But if you got a problem with that, that's your problem. Because the father in this story is just anything but emotionless and indifferent. If you think that the maturity is not having any sort of emotion, that's actually not a Christian idea. That comes from the Greeks, comes from the Stoics. That's why we use the term Stoic. It's not a Christian thing. And the father in this story has a big heart for his kid. So you're welcome to follow along if you like. It's Luke 15. I'm going to read it to us. Luke 15, starting at verse 11. Jesus is telling this story. And next week, we'll talk a little bit more about who he's telling it to. I just want to get into the story this week and focus on the younger brother. Jesus tells the story, and he says, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, give me what's coming to me. Give me my inheritance, my share of the estate.' So the father divided his property between his two sons. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, and he set off for a distant country. And there he squandered his wealth in wasteful living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country, who sent him to the fields to feed his pigs. The son longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, 'How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare? And here I am starving to death. I'll set out and I'll go back to my father and I'll say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me one of your hired servants.' So he got up and he went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and he was filled with compassion for him. And he ran to his son, and he threw his arms around him, and he kissed him. And the son said, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger. Put sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast. Let's celebrate. For this son of mine was dead, and he's alive again. He was lost, and he's now found.' And they began to celebrate. Meanwhile, the older son was out in the field. And when he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants, and he asked him what was going on. 'Your brother's come home,' the servant replied, 'and your father has killed the fatted calf because he has him back safe and sound.' And the older brother became angry, and he refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But the brother answered his father, 'Look, all of these years I've been slaving for you, and I've never disobeyed your orders. You never gave me even a young goat so that I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fatted calf for him.' 'My son,' the father said, 'you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead. He's alive again. He was lost and is found.' This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God." What is going on with this younger son? The younger son, the younger brother, probably has some negative self-talk. And he's been telling himself lately that he's got better options somewhere else. And they don't include family and chores and responsibilities, right? And he started telling himself that I've got more important things to do. And it doesn't include any of what's going on around here. What I want is more important than our family. And he asked for his inheritance. You only get that when they die. So what he says to the father is, "I wish you were dead. Because you're not dead, I wish you were, and I want what's coming to me now. I've been waiting for your money. I've been waiting for you to die. I like your money more than I like you. So give it to me." Now, before we are too hard on the younger son, let's remember, Jesus is telling this story about God the Father. God the Father is the Father in this story. And how many times have you and I told God the Father that we wished you were dead and really just want his money and the things he can do for us and not so much the relationship with him? That's secondary. What I really need is for you to do what I want right now. And I don't really care as much about our relationship with you. How many of us have done that? Yeah, I'm in this story. Sometimes we choose our own ways, and we essentially tell God we wish he were dead. And the Father lets him choose. I find this really interesting. You know, a relationship that is forced is not really a healthy relationship. And so the Father recognizes that, and he lets this son choose. He lets him choose the path that's going to hurt the Father. He lets him choose the path that he knows is self-destructive. And that hurts the Father even more, watching your kid do something that you know is going to hurt them. He knows the kid's going to hurt himself, but he lets him go. What choice does he have in that sense? And it's not long before that son packs up his stuff and he leaves at the front door. And what did that father go through? I can tell you. Grief. Loss. As you grieve the loss of that relationship, because there are reminders everywhere of your kids. You can't walk to your bedroom without passing their bedroom, and it's empty. And you look around your house, and you see the family pictures, and there are more people in that picture than are in the house right now. And it's painfully quiet at times. Chantel said to me a couple weeks ago, "This must be how God feels." Yep, she gets this story. So does God go through that? Does God experience grief like that and experience our absence? Does he feel that loss? Why wouldn't he? Why wouldn't he? You know, if 8 a.m. is the time that you talk to God every day, and 8 a.m. hits, and he doesn't hear from you, does he not experience that as loss? Does he not miss you? Does he not wish you were there? Why wouldn't he? If you make a habit of going to youth group or church on a weekly basis to worship and spend time with God and you don't show up, does God not experience that as absence and loss? If you're not going because you don't want to make eye contact with God right now because you're not on good terms, doesn't he experience loss that way? Why wouldn't he? God's a person. He has a full range of emotions. When you turn the radio up to drown out the... Does God not experience that as loss? Does God not grieve the times that you should be together and aren't? I think he does. I think, in fact, God has to live. I think God has to live with a lot of long-term pain, actually. Because God has to go on watching people hurt themselves. God has to go on watching the kids that he loves make self-destructive choices. Maybe God even has to live with the pain of hoping that they'll come back and not being so sure. So the son is making the most of his freedom. And he gets out. He gets way, way out. He doesn't just leave town. He leaves for a distant country. He puts a lot of distance between himself and his family, and he's got a chance to start fresh. He's an unknown commodity now. He can be whoever he wants to be there. And he starts living it up. You know, what would you do if you were off the leash for the first time and you had lots of money? You ever turn on the TV and see people with lots of freedom and lots of money? It always goes really well, doesn't it? Like, always. Entertainment Tonight, right? Seriously. Well, this son is no different. He's living it up the first time. But from Jesus' point of view, the only way that he can describe whatever it is that that son's doing is by using the words squandered and wasteful. That's Jesus' vocabulary for what the son is doing right now. When you look up that word wasteful in the Greek dictionary, it has another example of a Greek text that's not part of the Bible. But it uses that word wasteful to describe a man washing his feet with wine. Wasteful. You ever seen someone light a cigar with a $100 bill? It's the same sort of thing. It's like just disgustingly wasteful. That's what's going on here. That's the way Jesus views what's going on. But the son thinks he's living the high life and he's getting away with things that he could never have got away with at home. But don't you look down on this idiot kid as though this parable is pointed at teenagers. It is not pointed at teenagers, and we will talk about it next week. But let's not be sort of condescending because we're older and know better. We don't. We are in this parable. So he's living it up, he's living in the moment, and he's feeling pretty secure, like life is going the way that he wants, and the money is starting to run out. And at the same time that the money runs out, catastrophe hits because there's a famine in the land. What happens? We experience this in Alberta, right? When the amount of something you need becomes scarce, what happens to the price of that? It goes up. So there's a lack of bread, and it's going to cost more for it. And it happens right at the time when the famine hits. The famine hits right at the time when his money runs out. So this guy is in real need because he can't just go down to the local government building and apply for some aid. They don't have that. And normally it's the family that's the support network. And the support system is gone. And this guy goes from stretch limo to the back of the line of the mustard seed. That's where this guy is right now because he's got no family anymore. Your family is your village. This is where it comes from. It's not just his father and his brother. That's not just the family. In their culture, the family is that extended family that actually becomes the village itself. And he's lost all of it. He doesn't have anywhere to go. Maybe, by the way, thanks for being our village. We felt loved and supported by you, and I appreciate that. He's got no one, and he's desperate. So what does he have to do? He's got to go down to the market. He's got to go down to the market, and he's got to go stand where all the other unemployed guys stand who are hoping to get hired out for a day working a job at a farm. And so he goes and he stands with those other guys. And the farmers come down, and they tour around the market, and they pick the guys that they know are going to work hard. They're going to pick the guys that they've picked before. And so younger brother here, younger son, is going to be the last one picked. And he's going to stand in the hot sun all day long, waiting and hoping and wondering if he is going to eat today. And he waits, and he waits, and everyone else gets picked. And then the last farmer comes. And the last farmer takes a good look at him and goes, "Oh, sorry, buddy, you're Jewish. You're not going to want this job." And the son says, "No way, I am so hungry. I am desperate. I will take your job. What is it?" And the guy's like, "You're not going to take my job. I can tell you're Jewish. The only job I got is feeding pigs." And the son's like, "I don't care. I'm desperate. Now you and I, you know, I had bacon and ham yesterday for breakfast. We don't think anything of it. Pigs are absolutely abhorrent, detestable animals to Jewish people. It's not just that they don't have the pig on the plate at breakfast. It's that they don't have a pig anywhere in their living area, anywhere in their village. They are despicable animals to the Jewish people. Absolutely despicable. They are scavengers. Dogs and pigs in the ancient world are scavengers. This is a four-legged vulture. Did you feed your family vulture? It's disgusting to these people. And he is so desperate that he will go and work with the pigs He says, I'll do it. And he's so desperate that when he's feeding the pigs, he wants to get down with them and eat what they're eating. That's what the text says. He has hit rock bottom because he's essentially becoming a pig himself. This is rock bottom for him. The work is degrading. The pay is pathetic. He can't fill his stomach with what he's making where he is. And he's lonely, and he's ashamed, and he's dying of hunger. And it's at that point that he comes to his senses. And I've been asking myself this week, how does he come to his senses? Because I'd sure like a formula. And I don't know. I don't know if it's a product of rock bottom. I don't know if it's divine intervention. I can't answer it. It's not there. But somehow he comes to his senses and he tells himself, he realizes, my father's lackeys have it better than I do. My father's lowest servants have it better than I do. They've got 3 square meals and I'm dying of hunger. And so he starts to prepare his speech. I'll go back and I'll tell my father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. That's true. And I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. That's true. Culturally speaking, that's true. He disowned his father. He opted out. He can't bank on this relationship anymore. And this parable doesn't work for Jesus or the audience if you tell me that he has options. Because everyone hearing the parable knows this kid has no options. He has no leverage with the Father. He has no leverage, and he knows it. Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Last part of the speech, but make me like one of your hired servants. So he rehearses the speech the whole way home. And he starts making his trip. And meanwhile, at home, life on the farm has had to go on. Farming work doesn't stop, even for grief. But the father's head is not really in it. He's on running on autopilot, and I think he's regularly scanning that horizon, hoping for a shape headed his way, hoping is safe. His son is safe and sound and will be willing to admit he made a mistake. And I think then some of the next words are probably some of the most beautiful ones in Scripture. While he was still a long way off. While we were yet sinners. While he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion and ran and put his arms around him and kissed him. The father's been waiting for him to come home. He's been checking his phone constantly for text messages. He's been going through the motions and he's been getting the work done, but it's been on autopilot because his kid's in a distant country and he's not sure if he's dead or alive. The insults that he took are nothing, nothing compared to the loss of a kid, because a bad day with a troubled kid is better than a good day without them. And the father's been experiencing that. And it's here in these verses that we see that the father hasn't just moved on with indifference and resignation. How do you move on from your kids? So the father sees his son walking towards him, and he runs. Old men don't run. Seriously. In their culture, old men never, never run. This is a deeply, deeply shameful act. What are they wearing? Robes. That means he's got to hitch up his robe and bare his skinny, ugly little legs in order to run. It is a deeply, deeply shameful thing. Old men don't run. ever. And they certainly don't welcome back with open arms kids who have publicly insulted them. Honor and shame, we don't understand this in Western culture. Their society is highly structured around honor and shame. If you publicly shame someone, it's the worst possible thing you could do. The son publicly embarrassed the father and brought shame to their entire family. And now the father says, I don't give a crap about that. And he runs because that's his kid. It's more important. It's more important than what the rest of the village thinks. So he drops his rake and he picks up his robe and he books it with his beard flapping in the wind. Because that's how much this father loves his kid. And he reaches him and he smothers him with affection. He didn't give him a handshake. And the son starts his speech, the speech that he's been practicing. I've sinned. I'm not worthy to be called your son. And the father interrupts. The son doesn't even get to finish. The father starts celebrating right away. Bring a robe, bring a ring, bring sandals. The father's joy is just overflowing and it spills over into the entire village. And he calls them and tells them to kill the fatted calf. That means it's village-wide party because a fatted calf is enough to feed their village. And the father wants to celebrate with everyone he knows. He wants everyone to be as happy and joyful as he is that this son is back from the dead. The father was heartbroken when he left, and he is celebrating, celebrating when he comes back. God celebrates when you come back. What can we take from this passage? First of all, the father says twice that this son of mine was dead. And you got to take that seriously, I think. Absence from the father is death. This is God we're talking about here. Absence from God means walking dead. And if you are the prodigal these days, and at this moment that you are living in that distant land, please, please, please remember that the moment that the father sees that son returning, he's running to meet him. God can't wait to meet you. And if you would like someone to walk that trip back with you, come talk to us. Let's walk back together. Please notice in this passage as well how much we matter to God. The father welcomes back a son who told him he wished he were dead and wanted his money more than the relationship. And that father runs, hugs, kisses, gives gifts, and throws a party because that's how much God loves you. You matter to God. You have value to God. God is not indifferent to you. You are missed when you leave, and you are celebrated when you come back. Notice as well how gracious this father is. This son, in their culture, deserved nothing but a public beating. That's the world that they lived in. That's what the audience would have expected to hear. He has no entitlement. He deserves nothing. And he knows it. He has admitted as much. The things that he left behind are now out of reach. And the son comes asking for a drop of mercy and compassion. And the father gives him a tsunami of grace. Grace is by definition something out of reach. We have no leverage. And God gives us this grace anyway. We were guilty, bankrupt, powerless. And God extends things to us that we don't deserve, because that's how gracious and compassionate and loving and forgiving this Father is to you and you and you and you. This is our God. I'll offer you a moment for reflection.